This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. This is the evening edition and I'm Arlene Weber. A few weeks ago, Tun Mahathir said that democracy was a dangerous idea and leads to a game of musical chairs. He made the comment during the Kuala Lumpur Festival held a few weeks ago here in KL and added that democracy led to people pulling each other down and the country remaining stagnant. He cited the politics in Egypt as an example, saying, "Someone becomes a prime minister and then people demonstrate and bring him down. They were so stable during Hosni Mubarak's time and then they wanted democracy. Look what happened." And while we're used to hearing bold statements from the ex-statesman, it's left us to question if democracy is indeed dangerous. Is democracy a threat or a unifying factor for the stability and progress of a country? We debate this today and taking the studio are Mubarak Wasi and Rafiq Saladin, preferred consultants and debaters from the Malaysian Institute for Debate and Public Speaking. Now a little background about our debaters this evening. Mubarak is a third-year economics student at IIUM from Bangladesh. He is the reigning Asian champion and the second best speaker of Asia. He's part of one of the top 10 teams in the world and is the world's best English as second language speaker of 2014. He is now a preferred consultant of the Malaysian Institute for Debate and Public Speaking. On the other side of the fence is Rafiq, a former law student at University Technology Mara and was the National and Asian Debate Champion in 2014. Rafiq debated for 4 years where he racked up 8 national and regional titles and has appeared in 15 grand finals. He has made the top 10 list of Asia's best speakers twice, coming in second last year. He is also now a preferred consultant of the Malaysian Institute of Debate and Public Speaking. With the introductions out of the way, let's talk ground rules. Each debater will have a set amount of time to argue their case. A bell will go off at the end of the said time, leaving our debaters just enough time to wrap up their arguments. We'll first start with Rafiq, who will be telling us why he thinks democracy is a threat. But first, a quick break. We'll be back on the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the Evening Edition. I'm Arlene Weber. We're with the debaters from the Malaysian Institute for Debate and Public Speaking, and today they'll be debating democracy, whether it's a threat or a unifying factor for the stability and progress of a country. Rafiq will start the ball rolling in his argument about why democracy is a threat.
Thank you, Arlene. So what I'll be talking to you about today is that democracy is a threat to the stability of a country. First, I'd like to point out that this debate and this discussion should not be about what democracy should be or an idealistic view of what democracy could be, but what democracy is now and how democracy functions in this reality, in this context that we live in today. The stance that I will defend is that democracy is the best and most ideal form of governance. That is true. However, it is harmful to a country that isn't ready to practice it, or it is harmful to a country in the context that democracy is something that cannot function. Firstly, I want to talk to you about how democracy functions and what happens when countries or societies aren't ready for democracy. So first, I'd like to posit that democracy requires a politically and intellectually mature society. In order to hold governments accountable, society needs to be politically aware and participative. That means society needs to be consistently engaging in debates, voting in elections, speaking out against government and state abuses. We also need things like a wide range of free and fair and private media. We need a wide range of non-governmental bodies to check the state. Now, all these things are present in, for example, first world democracies. We have a wide range of media in America, ranging from the more conservative Fox News to the more liberal news media. We have, for example, non-governmental bodies like Human Rights, Transparency International and WikiLeaks, who consistently alert society when the government is misusing its power. So in order to do this, we need people who have we need society to have high levels of education so that when they go and vote in elections, they make the best decisions in those elections. We also need people to have high income levels, because if people are too poor, they're too busy caring about food and shelter and not about more advanced political discussions like taxes or free trade and tariffs and etc. So with this, I have three major harms I want to talk about. First, when society is not ready and when a country isn't ready, governments can abuse the system. How do they do this? Now, although democracy exists, the government will create a facade of democracy. So the democratic mechanisms exist. So there are elections, there are parliamentary debates and parliamentary processes, but these things are simply a veil to cover up a government that could misuse these mechanisms. So elections may be rigged, blackouts may happen, corruptions and misuse of power can be used by the state, but at the same time, the state has the excuse that we are practicing democracy. We saw, for example, Pervez Musharraf using the military to overthrow a democratically elected government in Pakistan. We saw Thaksin Shinawatra in Thailand using his power to benefit the people who supported him and to take out the opposition members. The second thing I want to talk about is that democracy in this context leads to the tyranny of majority. So when the society of a country isn't ready, elections and political discussions stop being about politics and start becoming about identity-based issues. Issues like race, like religion, like whether or not you support the monarchy. This is because people aren't ready to discuss mature political concepts like free trade or like taxes, and are more keen to discuss things that are identity-based issues. So for example, we see in Thailand, because Thailand and its society isn't necessarily ready for democracy, a lot of their political discussions are controlled by the red and the yellow shirts, whether or not you support the monarchy or not. In Egypt, for example, after the Arab Spring, the debate on politics becomes one about Islam, whether or not you support the Islamic Brotherhood or whether or not you support the more secular groups. The third harm I want to talk to you about, and what this tyranny of majority leads to, is that minority groups become disenfranchised. We see this, for example, happening in this country, in the sense that because our politics is largely defined by race and by religion, a lot of minority groups who do not fit into the majority become subsumed within this discussion. In the government coalition, for example, very little power, very little freedom is given towards the Malay Chinese Association or the Malaysian Indian Congress, and they become subsumed to larger majoritarian parties like the United Malays National Organization. So in conclusion to all this, I would posit that although democracy is a good form of governance and is the most ideal form of governance, that it shouldn't be imposed on countries who simply aren't ready to practice it.
Thank you, Rafiq. Now let's hear what Mubarak has to say in opposing Rafiq's views.
I want to argue today that democracy for all kind of nations, not just for the Western liberal democracies, but all kinds of nations, countries such as Afghanistan, to Iraq, to countries in Asia, for them, democracy is most likely to provide a form of stability, especially compared to the alternatives that are existing for these nations. So I think this debate must happen at a comparative as to which kind of a system is most likely to provide a form of stability for these nations. Keeping that in mind, let's look at what is likely to happen as a result of a democracy versus a system where democracy does not exist. The first thing that we want to talk about is we must reject this notion that it is based on what situation the country is in. It is based on whether or not people are only able to decide if they're educated and if they're really highly, like have high incomes and they belong to privileged societies. We think, first of all, we must realize is that is an argument from Rafiq to say that poor people in American societies should not be able to vote just because they're not rich, just because they did not get the highest levels of education. But in fact, we believe that it's much more simpler. We think that people should have the ability to decide and do have the ability to decide based on whether or not their lives are better at the end of a 5-year period, for example. You don't need to know the specific economic policies of a country to decide which way to vote. And in fact, most Americans don't know either, right? So I think the fact that poor people can at least decide whether or not their lives are objectively better or not after the government came into power, whether or not the government did anything for them, means these people do have some form of ability to decide. The thing that we must say is that, yes, sometimes facades of democracy are created by governments. Sometimes they try to manipulate democracy. But the thing is, at least a democracy gives us some leeway to be able to fight those systems, as opposed to a system where there is no democracy to begin with. So Rafiq wanted to talk about Egypt and Thailand and all those kinds of realities. Let's talk about Egypt and Thailand. I would argue that the reason Egypt is in this turmoil is because the military decided to take power and is now arbitrarily going ahead and killing huge amounts of people and recently sentenced Morsi to death for no reason at all. We would argue that in a democracy, at least Morsi had some checks on his power. That meant that secularists were still able to be in parliament. Yes, some of the discussion could have been driven by ideology, and it is not perfect, but we would argue that at least different kinds of ideas and perceptions were taken into account in that particular system. The comparative is, when the military comes into power, the military decides whatever it thinks is best, without any regards for any kinds of minority opinions, for any kinds of counter opinions, because they don't have to consider them. In terms of media power, they now can stifle any kind of dissent because no one can now speak against them. At least democracy allows for an alternative voice to say, what is happening is wrong and I can give you a viable alternative. Sometimes it is difficult because sometimes governments try to manipulate democracy, but at least that option exists. At least there is a possibility of that change coming in. But in a dictatorship, that does not happen. The thing is that even if you want to talk about Thailand, the vast majority of problems occur in Thailand because the military arbitrarily decides to take over democracy and take over power. That is where the crux of all this instability lies. But let's assume that stability exists. I would question whether or not stability is a good thing to begin with. I mean, North Korea is stable. That doesn't mean that it's a good country to live in to begin with. On one hand, in a sense, they are stable. But on the other hand, this also creates instability in the sense that the government has now the ability to solidify power in any way it sees fit without any sense of being questioned. At least in democracy, you have to stand up and defend yourself before an election. At least you have to stand up and defend yourself against arguments that other parties may raise. That's the comparative here. But also, we would argue whether or not a lack of democracy necessarily means stability, because there are always power squabbles that happen within these nations. Just because you don't have democracy does not mean that there is no rival factions fighting for power. We can look at Afghanistan, where the monarchy used to exist. And then there was a coup. And then there was a Russian invasion. And then there was a civil war. And then the Taliban took over power. All of those things happened. And it was really bloody and people died. And all of those things happened because people felt that they could no longer represent themselves in any way whatsoever. And there were multiple parties that wanted power but had no legitimate way to get there. That turned into violence. That meant the monarchy was overthrown because there was no other way to overthrow the monarchy, which was abusing its power to begin with. All of these power struggles means the transition from one power to another in an absence of democracy exacerbates all of the violence that occurs in these nations really, really badly. But in terms of minorities, what would posit is that minorities get to tend to have some form of participation representation in a democracy compared to a situation where there's an absence of democracy. At least, as Rafiq pointed out, in terms of the coalition, at least there is a coalition. At least there is a coalition where they can say that we have to vote along these lines. At least they can stand up in an election and say, if you want to hold my coalition, the minority parties can say, you must agree to these certain conditions and rights of minorities. In an absence of democracy, majorities rule without any forms of checks on them, right? For instance, in the United States, the reason why African American populations are often catered to is because the Democrats decided they need their votes. So they do cater their policies to them. They can be swing voters on an election as being a minority. However, in absence of democracy, even that small leeway does not exist. We would also say that in these nascent democracies that Rafiq wants to talk about, insurgencies are often created as a result of parties feeling that they are not aptly represented within parliament. For instance, in Turkey we saw that because the Kurdish were separated from the democratic process because they were said they do not belong to the democracy, that is when they felt that they had to take up arms to fight against the government. This is when a lot of violence happened. However, even when insurgencies exist within a democracy, we can think that they can be co-opted into the democratic process, like we saw in Ireland with the IRA. Even though it was a terrorist organization, we could have negotiations with them. We could moderate them because we could promise them that at least your voices will be heard because we live in a democracy. And that is what means that some forms of stability can happen. Leaders may change, but true stability only lies within nations if you're able to hold peace in the long run. That is, only, yes, democracies are not perfect, and sometimes it goes wrong. But in the absence of democracy, it only can get worse.
Thank you, Mubarak. We're going to break to the news, but when we come back, both the boys will be giving us their closing arguments about why democracy is a threat or a unifying factor to the stability and progress of a country. We'll be back on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. And we're back on the Evening Edition today, debating democracy and whether it threatens or unifies a country. I'm Arlene Weber, and joining us are Mubarak Wasi and Rafiq Saladin, consultants and debaters at the Malaysian Institute for Debate and Public Speaking. We'll now let Rafiq share his closing arguments as to why he thinks democracy is a threat to a country.
Thank you, Arlene. To an extent, I would agree with Mubarak that this debate needs to happen on a comparative between the system of democracy and other existing systems. But at the risk of sounding seditious, I won't defend a dictatorship or a military or a communist state. But unfortunately, at the risk of sounding unpatriotic, I would argue that sometimes an autocracy or a guided democracy like what we saw in Singapore, sometimes can actually work better. Now let's look at Singapore as an example. When Singapore was conceived, it was conceived in a baptism of fire. It was facing the threat of communism and communist guerrilla forces from Malaya. It was also conceived based on race-based tensions that were already occurring between ethnic Malays and Chinese groups in Malaya. Now, under the Lee Kuan Yew administration, and this is famously noted by many people who support democracy, Lee Kuan Yew, denied democracy and with this was able to focus the attention of the Singaporean people away from questions of race, questions of identity, and towards creating a burgeoning merit-based economy. So by stopping people from having the ability to define the government, because people were defining themselves based on things like race, the government was able to focus on economic growth, to focus on, for example, securing financial and economic stability before it focuses on things like identity. Therefore, Singapore now has grown into the richest state in Southeast Asia and is continuing to shame us to an extent. And I would just like to make it clear that I do love my country, but unfortunately, sometimes my country doesn't necessarily love me. My conclusion is that when countries are significantly poor or are still developing, we don't get to have these ideal democratic processes that Mubarak wanted to talk about. Now, an economist by the name of Francis Fukuyama, in a book called The End of History and the Last Man, once noted that when people are too poor or when societies are not necessarily reaching the significant levels of education, we don't get to have political discussions, mature political discussions, like discussions about taxes or trade deals or military spending or human rights or freedom of the press. Unfortunately, we're too stuck on trying to solve poverty and too stuck on identifying ourselves based on our race and our religion, because essentially we have nothing else to care for, because most of our civilians are living under the poverty line. There's not a large enough middle class to care about important democratic discussions. Also, as I would like to conclude, that when we don't have significant democratic institutions like a free and fair media or a large pool of free and fair media, unlike what we have in, for example, Great Britain and America, it is hard for us to check on our governments. When non-governmental organizations like Transparency International or Human Rights Watch isn't able to question the state or isn't able to put forward citizens' concerns towards the state, it's hard for us and it's hard for these institutions like the media, like NGOs, to be the beacon of accountability when citizens themselves can't be those very same, can't hold their own governments accountable. So in conclusion, I agree democracy is great. I agree that it is ideal, but in the context of these states, in the context of developing states, states with a small middle class, states with high level of poverty, states with controlled or state-owned media, in countries where non-governmental organizations do not have significant powers to check the government, I would even to the extent argue that an autocracy or other forms of governances are better, and that democracy truly is a tool and a threat to the stability of these countries.
Thank you, Rafiq. We'll be hearing what Mubarak has to say in his closing arguments, but for now, we're heading for a quick break. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. It's the Evening Edition and I'm Arlene Weber. We've come to the conclusion of our debate this evening about whether democracy threatens or unifies a country. We've heard what Rafiq had to say in his closing argument about why democracy is a threat. Now Mubarak tells us why he thinks democracy is a unifying factor for any country.
Rafiq's stance on democracy is somewhat confusing. In his first speech, he notes that democracy is not good, because in reality, it is imperfect. Because in reality, some countries tend to create a facade, and that is bad. In his second speech, however, he raves about the great Singapore, which is an imperfect democracy, which has created a facade of democracy in its early days. We would argue that this is exactly what I've been saying all along. That it is the path to democracy, even if imperfect, is what nascent countries must follow as well. And that is why Singapore has been able to do well. It is in fact that it is because of this situation that Lee Kuan Yew, because he followed the democratic process eventually, he was able to leave power when he needed to leave power and leave it on and leave the nation in capable hands on the hands of the people. But it is also an assertion to make to say that just because there's an absence of democracy, we will have an extremely capable leader like Lee Kuan Yew all the time and be able to have an a really good nation. We must also calculate the risks involved. It is just as likely, and in fact more likely, that leaders are likely to be power hungry in a situation where they're given unlimited power and are likely to abuse that power. We point to situations such as the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in an absence of democracy, how they manipulated and abused power. We would point to Omar al-Bashir in Sudan, who has committed genocide on his people as a result of trying to control that power in a situation where democracy does not exist and people are willing to go to any means to hold on to power. There is no saying as to how bad it can be. Democracies may not be perfect, but the thing is, the comparative and what can be the comparative, the alternative, is a nightmare that no one would want to go through. This is also true. We must understand that in his first speech, Rafiq wanted to talk about minorities and their protection. We think it is extremely critical to realize that democracy is the only way for minorities to be able to represent themselves. As much as he derides the identity and religious politics, he must recognize that even in the absence of democracy, leaders are also often based on identity, are also often driven by their religion. These are leaders who often take it out on those minorities. We would, this is something that we must take into account, because it is just as likely a Hindu nationalist or a Muslim religious bigot would also come to power, right? So we would posit here that even in South Africa, right, we didn't see an absence of identity politics during apartheid. In fact, we saw racially biased politics in the absence of democracy there. So we would posit that it is only through democracy that we can eventually move on from the identity politics, because as the discussions continue, we realize that we are, at the end of the day, fighting for a common goal. And it is only through this method that we create an incentive to move on, because leaders realize that they must cater to not just people from their own races, but in order to get more and more votes, they must cater to all religions, to all races. And that is the only way they can hold on to popular power. And we think that is why democracy creates a system where people finally and eventually move on from their bigotry, from their identity politics. And that is why democracy, on a comparative, is a much better system to be under, regardless of what kind of a nation you are on, regardless of what level of development the country may be at.
And there you have it, folks. A debate about democracy this evening, whether it's a threat or a unifying factor for any country. Who did you agree with and who do you think made valid points? You can text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio to let us know your thoughts. A big thank you to both Rafiq and Mubarak of the Malaysian Institute for Debate and Public Speaking for joining us this evening. You've been listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.